are going to talk with the author of American Character, a history of the epic struggle between individual liberty and the common good. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. How should our government balance the desire for individual liberties and the need to find the common good? Is that even possible? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Is there a current politician or elected official whose approach you agree with? Let us know. Our guest is Colin Woodward. He is the state and national affairs writer at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. His new book is American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So you start the book with the story of the Pilgrims and the first American colony. How does this story set the stage for many of the American conflicts to come?
Well, the story of Thanksgiving has become captured in what I think is the epic American conflict, which is over these differing views of what freedom really means. Freedom as maximizing freedom and liberty of the individual, and freedom as building a free community. And those things often come into conflict. And even the Pilgrim story, the sort of founding story of the Mayflower arriving off Cape Cod and the signing of the Mayflower Compact and surviving the early difficult winters, became captured during the Cold War and ever since into a sort of battle about the meaning and lessons of this sort of, you know, important mythic part of the American story, with some during the height of the Cold War starting to develop this theory that the Pilgrims' early experience was communism, because they were worried about communism at the time, and that its decision to make some policy changes were free market decisions and showed that the path forward and the correct and provident way to do things was to break up, communal and collectivist institutions to maximize individual liberty in a sort of libertarian argument that saved the day, and that, you know, communism has been tried and has failed, as it is often put. So the story is told by Rush Limbaugh regularly on Thanksgivings as well. It's quite a bit at variance with the actual story of what happened, both in timeline and in content, but it shows just how powerful this polarization is between these views, that even the sort of national beginning mythic story gets caught up in that very narrative.
You say that throughout our history, the real conflict hasn't been between Republicans and Democrats or the Republican and Democrat philosophies, but rather over competing definitions of freedom. What are those different definitions of freedom?
One way of looking at freedom in the American context is a very individualistic one. I mean, the conflict boils down to when individual liberty and the common good come into conflict, on which side should you err? And reasonable people will agree and disagree in the center, but as you move out towards the extremes, you start working into a idea of freedom as maximizing the individual's liberty, and that government and any other obstructions to it are a denial of freedom and are despotic. And in the other direction, you have the idea that you're trying to build the freedom and the common good of the community, which may require restraining individuals who destabilize it. And as you go off into the extremes, you start getting off into a collectivism of individuals being denied free motion and autonomy, and you can commit thought crimes, and pretty soon you're with Stalin, Soviet Union, and Hitler's fatherland. So in both directions, you can end up in tyranny. In the individualistic direction, when government becomes so weak, there's no more restraints, then some people maximize their freedom and end up, in effect, taking it away from others, and you end up in a situation like today's Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras, where the government is extremely weak, and a few families have managed to grasp control of, you know, everything, the land and the police and the army and the courts. So you can end up in tyranny either way. The question is, how do you maintain mass human freedom, liberal democracy, which we've been working at for as a species for three centuries or so, with trial and error and not always successfully. And the answer, which the book zeroes in on in the American experience, is how do you balance those two elements of freedom that are so essential but have to be in equilibrium? Because if you run with either one, you grab the ball into the end zone in either direction, you've just, you know, ended up in a tyrannical regime. And that's why it's so tricky, is because it's a matter of balancing things. And the book is looking at the historical experience of our country in what has happened as we've experimented with different combinations of that and where a path forward might lie.
So what are some moments in our history where these values have most come into conflict?
Well, they've come into conflict many times from, you know, our early origins all the way through to today. And they often break on geographic lines, not just ideological ones, because this book sort of builds off a prior book called American Nations, which talks about the actual regional divisions in our country, which don't follow state boundaries. And they're very profound, and they're tied to the differences between the original European colonies on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States, which were founded by people with very different ethnographic and religious and political and ideological orientations, who were building several very different visions of what would become America. And they ended up colonizing through the 1840s pretty much mutually exclusive strips of the United States out beyond the Mississippi. And a lot of the institutions and assumptions that are built into the sort of unquestioned, you know, ideas about, you know, how society should work were sort of baked into the cultural DNA of each of those regions. And the way that each of those regions looks at this central question of individual liberty versus the common good and where the balance should lie and what the appropriate balance point is are extremely different. And in some cases, as in the sort of Deep South versus the Yankee northernmost tier of the country, are almost profoundly oppositional. And that's led us to everything from the, you know, differences in which side supported the English Civil War in the 1640s to the U.S. Civil War in the 1860s, the orientation of different regions when the American Revolution happened as to whether you'd be loyalist or patriots and for what reason, and all the way through to the electoral map and almost any closely contested presidential election in our history, including the recent ones. And the parties come and go. You know, you mentioned the parties. The Republicans and Democrats over the past, you know, 80 years have completely reversed polarity and constituencies. If you were to look at a map of, say, you know, Woodrow Wilson and Charles Hughes in 1916 and look at a blue-red county map, it would look a lot like today's map, you know, profoundly so, except the colors are reversed. The constituencies change, and, you know, the early parties like the Whigs or the Jeffersonian Democrats or the Federalists come and go, but these divisions and divisions about these ideas of freedom are things that have been lasting in our experience that the parties kind of, you know, reorient themselves around. This is the drumbeat of the metronome behind the music.
So which is it, a freedom or the common good that we have tended to choose more often?
Well, these are both ideas of freedom, right? The common good, the idea is your ultimate goal isn't maximizing individual freedom, but rather trying to create and sustain a free community. And of course, either of these things gone to excess can be bad things, but in the sort of liberal democratic realm, the idea is that you have to build shared institutions and such in order to have the possibility that everybody has a reasonably fair shake at birth of being able to, you know, be autonomous and free individuals. And that if you don't have those structures, if you don't have, you know, schools and parks and basic security and such, that you end up in a situation where the strong end up, you know, accreting over the generations more and more power and influence, and eventually can capture government and markets. And it's not theoretical. We went through it in the Gilded Age with the great tycoons, you know, in the 1870s through the 1910s, and then again in the 1920s, where there was a laissez-faire period in government, where the assumption was that government should be as sort of a night watchman and be as unintrusive as possible. And that led to huge monopolies, which greatly distorted the economy, and the capturing of many of our political institutions to the point where people's civil liberties to, you know, speak out or strike or whatever it would be were actually being compromised. So it's not a theoretical problem. We've been through it. We've been through it in on both edges of what the American electorate writ large will tolerate.
So how do you see this conflict playing out in American politics today in terms of real specific examples of what's going on?
Oh, pick any issue. I mean, the gun control issue is a classic one where, maximizing the freedom of the individual to possess and display and carry around firearms, and preferably of the broadest distinction possible, versus a common good idea that there have to be some restrictions on that in order to maintain the security of the community, because some subset of the people going around carrying guns will be, you know, of ill intent or deranged and you know, start hurting and denying other people the freedom to be alive. I mean, those are basic conflict points. And you see that in all sorts of issues in the U.S., you know, the question of, say, the battle over Apple and the FBI over the iPhone. You know, what's the correct balance of the civil liberties of the, you know, owners of phones and rights to privacy to the government's desire for the you know, common good, in quotes, to be able to maintain security by monitoring these things?
Yeah, in fact, so you see it in... I'm sorry to interrupt, but as we're coming up to a break, since you brought up the Apple example, we did want to ask you about that with that battle going between Apple and the FBI. A federal court has ordered Apple to help the FBI break into the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooting suspects in order to gather some evidence. Apple is refusing, saying this could set a dangerous precedent. How do you see this playing out?
Well, this is an interesting one, because how it would play out in the terms I've just outlined depends on whose brief you want to believe. The government, the FBI's point of view is a classic, you know, individual liberty, common good balance point. How do you balance those things, just as I mentioned? But Apple's argument is that if you force us to create this software that doesn't exist, this master key that in effect could unlock any iPhone anywhere, you're actually building a device that bad guys and, you know, terrorists and whatnot could use to unlock anybody's devices from anywhere, in theory, remotely. So their argument is that the government's own argument for protecting the common good is undermined by building this device. So if you take the FBI's point of view, this is sort of a classic argument over the correct balance. If Apple is correct in their technical assertions, then it becomes a bit more murky, because if the common good served or not by, you know, creating this sort of software virus that could head on out there, and if it escaped from the FBI or was used by others, could end up making everybody's security questionable, because you have the ability to, in theory, to have access to the microphones and GPSs and cameras and such of iPhones all over the place. So a Pandora's box argument.
Colin Woodward is the author of American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. And we welcome your questions for him and your thoughts on this at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Our guest is Colin Woodard. He is the author of American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. And we are talking about how today's leaders might be able to strike that balance between individual freedoms, individual liberties, and the common good. And we welcome your thoughts and questions. Do you think that there is a current politician or public figure whose approach could do this? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We have some Facebook comments. Let me go to Gary on Facebook, who says, "The pack is the wolf, and the wolf is the pack." Unlike socialism in America, individual initiative, innovation, and freedom is recognized as essential to promote the welfare of society. So, Colin, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, that's true to a certain extent. Our society has unlocked individual initiative and innovation and all of those dynamic forces, which have made us a very powerful and world-changing force in both ideas and technology and almost everything. But the idea that, say, in Europe, in a social democracy in Europe, the idea is that you have free market capitalism and you take and, you know, power a robust set of social welfare and social services much larger than we would have. So it's sort of a taxation thing. The idea, you know, the innovative idea is not necessarily lost on, say, the Finns or and such who created Nokia and all kinds of high tech companies that were at the cutting edge of things. So it can be overstated, the distinctions between Europe and the US in that regard. But he is touching on something important. I mean, we don't, you know, the part of the success in the American experience has been allowing individuals to have, you know, a much greater degree of freedom than anybody in the 17th or 18th centuries would have imagined was possible. And that was the big challenge at the time of the American Revolution, the American experiment. The whole conversation was between, you know, trying to gain greater freedom for the people, who at that time were the sort of educated, gentlemen and aristocratic class, against the crown or the king or the government. And that was the whole battle, sort of zero-sum game between those two forces. And, you know, John Locke and a lot of the theorists that built the original ideas about how you would have mass freedom and you know, be able to dispense with supposedly divinely ordained monarchies, that was the whole focus. But that conversation kind of missed that there are really three legs to the stool, right? You've got the government or the king, you've got the aristocracy or the oligarchy, and you have the people. And you need the three to be sort of in balance to maintain the most freedom possible for everybody. So, I mean, the wolf is the pack, and the pack is the wolf. Well, you know, is it? You know, are there other packs out there, and does one pack defeat the other? What does the big wolf do when he, if he's allowed to conquer everybody else? Is the rest of the pack end up free or not? I don't know. That the metaphor starts getting rather sticky thereafter. So it's about, you know, it's the central point that he's making is a correct one, but that doesn't mean that that it isn't a question of maintaining a balance point to have that condition where, you know, you can have a virtuous cycle of individuals contributing to the common good. Because if you remove all of, you know, a great deal of government regulation and security and structure and infrastructure and stuff, that condition where that can be true falls apart.
Meanwhile, Andy on Facebook says, I think that it makes the most sense to involve government when individual liberties are in conflict. For example, a business owner may want the liberty to dispose of their waste products into a watershed. People who use the water want the liberty of having access to clean water. That's why we have the common good conversation in the first place.
Yes, I mean, the central problem is if a person maximizes their freedom, they are in fact starting to reduce the freedom of others as they really, really maximize it. You know, the big wolf ends up conquering all the rest of them and there's nobody left. And that's the problem that happened in the Gilded Age and at other times. And the key thing is if you're going to have, you know, this sort of, struggle, you know, innovative struggle of individuals that's based on merit, where people have the freedom to experiment and succeed and fail and all that. In order to have those things and have that actually happen, the game that you're playing has to be fair, and you have to prevent, you know, monopolies from forming up like they did in the Gilded Age, and you have to do something about the intergenerational consequences of that, because, you know, you cycle forward three or four generations and wealth and power tend to accumulate to the winners and be passed down further. You end up with people who are being born with very little chance to participate in it. And that will eventually lead you a few generations down the road to a situation that's no longer free, where a lot of people in effect don't have much freedom of motion. So how do you keep it so that the game, you know, in each new generation, that each new generation does have, you know, a fair shot, regardless of birth, at trying to, you know, realize and, you know, experience their personal potential. You know, there's a balance point to allow that to happen. Remember, liberal democracy, the idea of this mass human freedom, has only been around as an idea for a few centuries, and we still haven't gotten it, you know, we still haven't necessarily gotten it right. It's a tricky thing. It's not a natural state of affairs. It's the product of thousands of years of preparation and 3 or 4 centuries of experimentation, and it requires all kinds of, you know, social structures and preconditions, and it's a remarkable human achievement, but it does require that you have the framework of the community to a certain degree to allow everyone's freedom to be available to have all of those, you know, innovations and to have the common good discussion remain valid.
Our guest is Colin Woodard. And Colin, I apologize for giving you the last name of another famous journalist earlier.
Colin, I might imagine.
He is an award-winning writer and journalist. He is the author of American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have a question or a thought or a view on finding this balance between individual rights and the common good. And Colin, you argue in the book that our liberal democracy requires that we find a balance between protecting individual liberty and the common good. Why is it necessary?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And it's something that, you know, the founding fathers were aware of. If you go back and read the Federalist Papers and Hamilton and Madison and Adams and his own writings are all aware of this sort of three-footed struggle between, that you have to keep those forces in balance or else you're going to lose that possibility of a republic and a democratic experience. It's just been sort of lost in our recent political discussion that, you know, it's not just that, you know, less taxes and less government will give you more freedom. I mean, it depends on where your starting point is. That might be very true if you're incredibly overtaxed and have an incredibly oppressive government. But as you move out towards the margins, you still get diminishing returns on that until the point where you're actually taking away a lot of the societal and civilizational infrastructure that allows the possibility of mass human freedom and individual liberty to exist. Individual liberty requires having a lot of these civilizational structures, which are common and shared structures and often, you know, need to be produced by government to have, you know, education systems and roads and libraries and parks and also the political discussions about how taxation will be oriented and who pays what and what should be spent for whom and for what reasons. Those are all important discussions, but you have to have a sort of functioning flywheel to keep the liberal democratic possibility going.
Let's take a call next from Randy in Middleton. Hello, Randy.
Good morning. I thought this very thoughtful discussion, and for about 150 years of our nation's history, we made these decisions by what we read in the newspapers. And lately, we're now seeing everything on TV, and we're sort of deciding how to vote according to what Oprah says. And I was just wondering how you feel about all this massive mass media, how they all are affecting our decision making.
It's an excellent question. I mean, it cuts both ways. I guess it's too early. The jury's still out on understanding what all of this means. The arrival of the internet and the mass democratization of information, where anybody can, in theory, put their voice out through a blog to everywhere in the world, and conversations go back and forth between, you know, the generators of the news and the people reading it. I mean, that should be a good thing in general, and I think it is. In a certain sense, we have more information than ever, and our potential ability to understand what's going on and have access to data and interact with other people is enhanced. However, in practice, it's ended up with a cacophony of voices and people being able to retreat often into their own information bubble, where they're surrounded by people reinforcing their set of opinions and even their own facts, to the point where there's no shared collection of facts around which to discuss how to go forward. And I think in the past, you would generally, you know, at least in the post-war period in the second half of the 20th century, you'd have a set of facts that in general were agreed on a big policy issue. And the argument was, what was the best way to deal with that problem or challenge? But now we don't even have an agreement on what the facts or the challenge is. So that's the bad part and the pathology of all this. And it's kind of hard to know how it's all going to settle out. It definitely is making it much, much harder to have a national discussion or even at the state level to have productive discussions, because you have constituencies who, might as well have been residing on different planets in terms of their understanding of what the problems are and what the facts are about those problems. So it cuts two ways, and I'm not sure in the end how it will play out. I'd like to be an optimist about these things, that as more information and more of that is available, that it will lead eventually to a more informed citizenry, which is a vital thing to the sustenance of any liberal democracy and republic. You have to have that. That's one of the societal preconditions I was talking about. You know, a lot of my answers sounded a little abstract, but you get concrete. You need people to know what's going on, because in a liberal democracy, relying on the public to be making ultimately the decisions, you know, as to who's going to govern and what's going to happen, and they need to be operating on good information. You know, they need to be well-educated and have the tools for critical thinking and all of those things, which are part of the civilizational infrastructure that makes this all possible. It's a virtuous circle when it's working right. And right now, technology has handed us an incredible challenge with great potential to do wonderful things, but also demonstrated potential to, you know, threaten the foundations of the republic as well. So I don't know which way it'll go, but it's certainly, you're right, that is a central issue of our times.
Yeah. Thanks, Randy. Colin, you've written that America is far too individualistic to tolerate social democracy, let alone socialism. Yet here we are with a democratic socialist presidential candidate who's closer to the nomination than anyone ever thought possible. How do you explain this?
Because when I make that statement about America, I'm speaking of America as a whole. If you look at the entire country, and I spoke about the differences between the regions, there are regions where the fundamental political culture going back to the, you know, early settlement is very individualistic or libertarian in different forms, especially in the Deep South and the Chesapeake region and throughout what I call Greater Appalachia, which is the largely Scotch-Irish-founded stretch not only of the uplands of the South, but that same settlement group went through the southern tiers of Ohio and Indiana and Illinois and large parts of Missouri and the Ozarks and on into even the Texas Hill Country. It's a very expansive area. Those areas, the ideas that of a social democrat, that you would have a very robust set of social protections and programs, and you would tax people to support those, runs against a strong commitment to individual freedom and individual sovereignty, and in Greater Appalachia, a great distrust of government, that government is the source of tyranny, because in the experience of the Scots-Irish and Ulster and their predecessors in the lowlands of Scotland, these were war-torn areas where government was ineffective and usually came to you in the form of an invading army who was going to destroy, you know, everything you and your family had. So the distrust of government was very great and has remained so. So stepping back, that on the Electoral College map or in the House or Senate map, it's very hard to create the supermajority you would need to capture the White House, because you have a number of regions where the dominant ethos is strongly against social democracy. I mean, yeah, social democracy works in many European countries and creates societies that have, you know, very successful free enterprise systems and a very high degree of, you know, wealth and happiness and all that. But it is, you've never, anytime you've headed down that road too far in the American experience, it's been rejected, and rejected pretty soundly. So, yeah, you know, Bernie Sanders will be successful in certain sections of the country. In that Yankee northern tier, he would be potentially competitive, depending on who he's running against. In the next tier down, which is a multi-ethnic and highly tolerant sort of communitarian zone that was founded by the Quakers initially but ended up with a multi-ethnic spread, you'd be potentially successful there. On the coastal area from San Francisco up to Juneau, Alaska, it has political traditions where, yes, a social Democrat could be successful, but that doesn't deliver you the electoral college. It doesn't give you enough. And I don't see on the mathematics of the map, it pretty much eliminates that possibility for a social Democrat. So it's not that certain regions of the country you couldn't potentially, in the right circumstances, have a social democracy be part of the conversation, but writ large in America, our historical experience has been entirely consistent over time that there's just not support for that, and there's a knee-jerk reaction against it whenever you start intruding off into that zone. The book gets into specifics about this. It follows the history, you know, in great detail of what happened and what our experience was and why. But that's why I say that in that passage in the book.
A caller who couldn't hold, who dropped, asks, what political party or candidate do you see best handling this need to balance these two concerns?
That's an excellent question. In the current cycle of people, well, you've got a lot of different takes on things. You know, the candidates that are on a sort of individual liberty through common good spectrum are clustered closest to the middle. You know, Hillary Clinton is closer to the middle than Bernie Sanders is. She, you know, comes from her husband was in the neoliberal tradition, which was sort of the triangulating of the wing of the Democrats after the 1960s, you know, the loss of their supermajorities in the 1960s. And in the Republican side, I suppose John Kasich is somewhat the closest on that arm, but you've got a lot of outliers. Bizarrely, and this may be one of the reasons for his success, is Donald Trump in those terms actually is kind of near the middle, but there's a little asterisk on it. I mean, I think that's why he's had quite a bit of success, is he's arguing, you know, unlike the rest of the general Republican platform has been to reduce regulations, reduce taxes, and essentially, you know, moving more towards the laissez-faire idea that you need to release individuals and entrepreneurship, and then everything will be fine, that things will be successful. He's not saying that. He's saying, you know, stop the bankers. He's against free trade. He's mm-hmm. for social programs, but the trick is it's for a certain set of us that is not everybody, and it's willing to deprive civil liberties and constitutional liberties and niceties to people perceived as the other, be they, you know, Muslim Americans or journalists or anybody who crosses him or says something mean about him on Twitter. So that's why people start talking about his authoritarianism. He's occupying a sort of middle ground of fairness. He's much more over onto the, you know, communitarian side of things than his Republican competitors, but he's willing to deny individual liberties and civil liberties to large numbers of people in violation of basic constitutional understandings of a liberal democracy. So in a sense, he's a candidate running against some elements of liberal democracy, which makes him a little bit, you know, more than a little bit of concern to anybody who cares about maintaining freedom and sort of the republic. But he's successful because he's also moved into that middle zone on the spectrum I've described of individual liberty versus community good. Well, how do you define a community?
Well, let's take Kelly in West Dallas next. Hello, Kelly.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. You know, I think we have way too much government in our lives, and it's getting more and more, and I think there is no more balance like it was at least a century ago. We need to help each other here our neighbors, our families. That's what it's all about. It's not about the government taking over. And look what's happened in Europe. Europe is under socialism, and look how they're suffering over there. Everyone, they're more in poverty. It's a mess over there. So, you know, and that's we're going along that route now, and it's not a good thing. Socialism has never worked in communist countries or in socialist countries. I come from a Latin American country. My family has, and they escaped because of the fact of communism / socialism. It doesn't work. There's only a top 1% that runs the country, and your liberties are totally taken away from you. So
yeah,
thank you.
Kelly, before you go, can you tell... Oh, she left. Wanted her to get an example on how she thinks we've moved much more towards socialism.
Right.
What's your, I guess, general reaction to that, Colin?
I mean, my reaction to the second half of what she said is that that's very true. I mean, I was living in as an exchange student in Eastern Europe during the collapse of communism, and that was the beginning of my journalism career, was for years afterwards covering what happened next. And I was in Ceausescu's Romania when Ceausescu was around, and traveling around that region for years, seeing the incredible damage that, you know, real, you know, we're not talking social democracy anymore, we're talking state socialism where it's not that you're harnessing a capitalist economy to fund a robust social welfare protection. It's that the state owns the, you know, all the means of production, that every factory and in the more orthodox countries, every restaurant and store is owned by the state, and it's all centrally managed, and essentially all of the wealth and production of society is centrally organized, and individuals don't have any rights of, any effective rights of freedom of speech or even thought. You're supposed to all agree with the ideology of the party. It's a horrible, tyrannical thing. But, you know, in running from that, correctly wanting to avoid that, one can run into the other far extreme where, I don't know which Latin American country the caller was from, but there are Latin American countries where government was extremely weak, was not at all socialist in quotes, and where they're some of the most dangerous and insecure and unpleasant and awful places to live because there was so little weakness that, you know, just a few people, as she was mentioning in her country, you had the same thing where a small number of people controlled everything. And you go off into states, you know, socialism and communism, and you have a small number of individuals who also control everything just through the fact that they're running the state. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with the polls. It's that, you know, the solution is not to run to one pole or the other. The solution lies in between those poles in the middle, and that's, as I keep saying, is the tricky part. And, you know, the social democracy lies within that middle realm. Just it's not going to work for us because our traditions are too individualistic. But the call is incorrect to think that, you know, the Swiss and Norwegians and, you know, Dutch and Finns and Danes and Icelanders are suffering and in terrible poverty. Those you should travel there. They're incredibly wealthy and highly organized societies with that aren't at all impoverished. You may or may not like their balance point that they've chosen, but that you can't argue that they're not successful in, you know, materialistic terms or general stability.
We are talking with Colin Woodard. He is the author of American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. And we are talking about how our society can find the sweet spot, in between individual freedoms and the common good. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. How do you think our government should balance individual liberties and the common good? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Colin Woodard is our guest. He is the author of American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. Let's take a call next from John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, Joy. I was entertaining the idea of getting rid of Social Security and Medicare, being as they're both socialist programs. And I also had the idea perhaps we should privatize roads, universities, and the military so that they're as accessible as Trump University.
There's certainly some struggles over this, Colin.
Yes. I think most of the public would be wary of privatizing all of the entire road system and everything else, because as we've seen in the stock markets and Wall Street, there are certain risks in privatizing everything. There are some things that aren't that profitable to produce well, certain social infrastructure things that are, what economists call market failures. You need somebody to step in because either it's not profitable to do it well in a way that produces the desired outcomes for society or maintains the infrastructure, or take postal service, which is semi-privatized and is having difficulty. The idea is that it's a public good, and it certainly was before the internet and email. You had to have the ability for people to efficiently and in a cost-effective way communicate with each other, no matter where somebody lived. That you would send a letter or a bill or correspondence or whatever it was to any town anywhere, and that it could be done at an inexpensive price. And some of those places, if you did that on a private model, it would never be cost effective to be delivering mail to people in deep rural areas. So a private company would get rid of those things and start looking like, lo and behold, Federal Express, right? You get the things that are most profitable and do them really, really well, and leave all of the unprofitable stuff to the sort of state mandated carrier. But the idea that you ought to have that kind of thing, or maintain roads and infrastructure in places where it doesn't make short term profit sense to, the idea is that that kind of infrastructure is a necessary investment for the common good in society at large that benefits ultimately the economy and everybody else. So it's sort of short-term versus long-term thinking. And a lot of that long-term thinking stuff, where the investments can be very long, aren't as appropriately made in the private sector because the risks and uncertainties are too large for the private sector actors. So yeah, there's definitely places where societies throughout history have seen that the public sector has a role. So I think that's reasonably clear in our historical experience as well.
Matt on Facebook says, universal health care is the defining issue in America at this point. We need to follow the lead of the rest of the free world and implement a single-payer plan. If you don't have health, you aren't capable of participating in the common good.
Oh, there's a classic and very relevant and front and center policy issue that boils down to those same sort of things. Absolutely. It's compounded by the current system, which is sort of a hodgepodge created in shortly after the Second World War. An employer-based system that was sort of adopted ad hoc hasn't been working all that well. So, you have the status quo not being acceptable to most people, so trying to, it's front and center to try to do something to figure out what the appropriate way forward is. And that's, again, a classic common good, individual freedom kind of argument.
Yeah, and look how the battles over health care, the battles over changing Social Security or Medicare, the battles, how does the United States strike the balance, that sweet spot that you're talking about, when it comes to our individual liberty and the common good?
Well, my general argument is that, I looked through history. The book traces our experience with it because, I didn't want to come up, hey, what does Colin Woodard think we ought to do? I wanted to look through in a sort of fact-based way what our historical experience is to find where the balance point has been in our past that had broad political acceptance. So that, imagining solutions pie in the sky that won't have political support, especially given that balkanized, divided regional cultural map that I described isn't going to get you anywhere. You need something that actually could work and delivers balanced results. And you get that period that, both left and right tend to look back as sort of the imagined golden age between, World War II and the early 1960s in economic terms, where you had widespread, middle class prosperity and people having much greater possibilities and educational possibilities and standard of living than their parents and grandparents had ever imagined. That was a period that was governed in sort of, you know, the Greater New Deal era. It wasn't social democracy, but there was a bipartisan acceptance of the idea that there would be shared, you know, government-provided infrastructure, spending, and such that benefited the entire country. That's when the interstate highway systems were built. The land grant and sea grant university systems were created. A lot of the enormous spending on things like the Apollo program and research and development to fight the Cold War that led the United States to be the, you know, leading technological power. And we're still seeing some of the benefits and spinoffs from that. So that was an era when the idea that you needed to have the, you know, we were facing an external threat, which helped with the Soviet Union, but the idea that we needed to, you know, sort of stand together and have those kind of infrastructure spending, and that did require higher taxes than we have today, created a era of widespread prosperity. Now, the economic conditions are different now. You know, we have many competitors on the global stage. You can't just rewind the clock. But some of the, if you go back and look at that period, which runs really from FDR through Eisenhower, really in a sense on through Nixon being the last exponent of that, and through like 1972, it's a very different balance on these different policy issues, and it did produce fairly successful results. It had downsides, and it certainly failed in the end, as you know, different patterns happen. But understanding why it did and understanding what it succeeded in is something the book focuses on to try to deliver a sense of where the sweet spot lies in our American political context.
Daniel on Facebook asks, was the aftermath of 9/11 and the establishment of Homeland Security the final death knell to the fiction of liberty in the United States?
Well, any external threat is going to, you know, something like that, an existential threat where people are worried, you know, who knows what's going to happen next? You know, are there going to be, you know, nuclear attacks on our cities or chemical weapons or anthrax? I mean, those are very trying times for a liberal democracy because we require, you know, liberal democracy requires individual liberties and civil liberties to be respected. And yet, if the community is in fear that it might be destroyed, you suddenly get a reaction where the public is willing to the continent's, you know, dictatorial powers for their leaders to keep them safe. So anytime you're in that situation, it's absolutely a challenge and has been for liberal democracies throughout. That really tests the strength of your republic when you're facing those situations. Can you weather them without, you know, destroying republicanism? So, yeah, that was a enormous trauma to the country. And in a different way, the 2008 financial collapse was a different sort of trauma, and they weren't that far apart. And I think that explains a lot of the current turmoil in the country are those two events, a fundamental security vulnerability to the country, and then a fundamental financial and economic one. And I think that that sort of set the stage for what we're seeing in 2016.
Yeah, well, we have just a minute to go. As we get closer to the presidential election, what would you like people to be considering when evaluating candidates when it comes to this balance?
Well, in whatever election cycle you're in, I think people need to be aware that you can't run to the extremes in either direction, that there are reasons. If you want to have more freedom and sustain freedom and sustain a republic, the answer is not to run to one extreme or the other, because therein lies tyranny. So you're looking for balances between the civilizational investments and structures and institutions that a liberal democracy needs to survive, and having a balance with making sure that individuals' rights and freedom and liberties aren't trampled upon. And that requires careful and considered thinking. So look for people who think and consider these things carefully.
Thank you so much for being with us. Colin Woodard is the author of American Character. This is the Ideas Network.